Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 7 of Tall But True. I can't believe we've done 7, or we're about to do our 7th episode. I'm Ben Bailey, I'm here again, as always, with my good friend and co-host, Mr. DC Benny. What's up, dude?
Just chilling, lucky number 7, ready to bring this. I think we got a pretty special guest today.
For lucky number 11, yes, yeah. We do. We have a big-time guest. This might be our biggest guest.
I think so.
I think it's our biggest guest. Our last guest was my neighbor, Bryce.
Well, Bryce might be a little bigger than this guest, but this guest lost some weight, so.
Tonight's guest, first tonight's topic is fate.
Fate?
Fate or destiny.
Destiny or fate.
Fate or destiny, and our guest is a big star, a great guy, and a friend of mine, Ray Romano.
Ray Romano, hilarious, good guy to the
super party. Good guy, yeah. such a regular guy.
Loved in the comedic community.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But not many are beloved in the comedic community.
No, many are spited.
Many are behated.
For much less success, are behated.
Yeah.
So this is Tall But True, where the tales might sound tall, but they are true. Yeah. This is episode 7, we're going to be talking about fate and destiny with Ray Romano right after this. All right, we're back. It's Tall But True with special guest Ray Romano. What's up, Ray? How you doing?
I'm good. How you guys doing?
We're doing great, man. Just sitting around telling stories. What are you up to? You working?
I'm working on a series based on the movie Get Shorty.
Oh, no way. That sounds awesome.
Was that Elmore Leonard?
Elmore Leonard, right? Yeah, nice call,
yes,
DC.
Yes, that's the original. Yeah, it's kind of based on it. It's kind of like Fargo, you know, like the TV show Fargo.
Yeah, I thought it was awesome. It's that kind of tone.
It's kind of a dark comedy, but it's pretty intense. And it films partly in L.A. and then partly in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh,
nice.
That sounds fun. You be spending a lot of time in Albuquerque?
So far, not a lot. So far, I've been there 2 days. I think I've seen all the sights already. But it's nice. I'm sure there's some nice golf courses there. So.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's got to be some desert golf out there.
Yeah, and it's 5,000 feet altitude, so I'll get an extra 30 yards on my shot.
Very nice.
But it's like playing in one giant sand trap. You're out there in the desert.
That's the thing. It's a 5,000 feet desert, really. You know, it's 5,000 feet up, but yeah.
I bet it gets cold at night, though, huh?
It is cold there. It's like down in the 20s now, they say, at night.
Right? Oh, wow.
But I'm in L.A. now. I'm here in warm L.A.
So. Oh, that's cool. That's nice. I love L.A. A lot of guys, like New York guys, are like, oh, fuck L.A. I hate L.A. I love it out there.
Yeah, I've been here. I came out when Raymond started.
Right.
Actually, I came the second year of Raymond because the first year I stayed in New York.
Weren't you waiting to see, like, you know, see how it goes before you make that big jump?
Did you guys shoot Raymond out there?
Yeah, we shot here. We shot in L.A. And the first year, you know, I had 3 little kids, and I wasn't going to move them out because who knows, you know, it could have got canceled.
Yeah.
So I did the first year, I went back and forth. And, you know, my wife was here with 3 kids under the age of 3. I had the twins.
Oh, Jesus.
So in the second year when we got picked up, she said, screw that, I'm coming out there.
You know? Right.
And I've been here ever since. So I've been here for almost 20. Can you believe that? It's been 20 years since Everybody Loves Raymond started.
Wow.
I can't believe it, man. I remember I was driving around when Everybody Loves Raymond first started. I was delivering prescriptions for a local pharmacy. And I remember hearing you on the radio doing promos for it.
Yeah.
And you were like, I'm just happy to get out of the house or something.
Doing my bits.
Oh, is that a bit? I don't remember you doing that one.
That's one of my bits I did on Letterman. Was one of my first jokes on Letterman was I have a 3-year-old and twin 1-year-old boys. Doesn't matter to me if you laugh or not. I'm just happy to be out of the house.
So that was like an adapted to the radio ad version. Oh, that's funny and probably very true at that time.
Absolutely. I don't know I had 2 1-year-olds and a 3-year-old.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's another bit I used to do is I would make offers to get out of the house. I would, anybody need anything from the motor vehicle bureau?
Anybody need anything from anywhere that will take a lot of time for me to get? Yeah, one kid is a lot. One 1-year-old will run you ragged.
It was a bit, but it was absolutely. I would kind of look forward to traffic. You know, I would look forward. Like if I was driving home from wherever, I was the only one without road rage in traffic because it was peaceful. You know, it was
calm. That's brilliant.
That's great.
That's a mindset that I need to embody that somehow because I'm filled with road rage. I was talking to a friend of mine saying, I don't know how you do it, man. He lives like 8 miles from where he works, but it takes him like an hour and 20 minutes every day to go and then the same to go back. And I realized at some point that it's kind of similar to what you're saying. That's like his only time that he has to himself.
Well, if he has kids, does he have kids?
He has three kids, two dogs. He's very busy at work. The time that he's in his car, he gets to like listen to his music. He gets to just have a little time for him.
My podiatrist, the guy who works for him that helps him, drives 2 hours both ways, like into the city. And then back out. And this happened after 9/11. Like, he got really flipped out after 9/11.
Oh, and moved out?
Yeah, he moved his kids out. He moved out. But he's like, he loves it. But I'm like, that's 4 hours a day with, you know, traffic. But I get it. You know, you must really, you know, recharge during the drive.
That was back then. Now the kids, I mean, shit, my youngest is, you know, I had another kid after that. When Raymond was on, in the second year of Raymond, we had another kid. And he's 18 now.
Wow.
This is 18.
Everybody loves Raymond. Such a great show, man.
Thank you.
I was doing a radio interview the other day, and they put a video on of Brad Garrett as Frankenstein in a McDonald's commercial. Have you seen that?
No, it's not McDonald's. It's Apple Music.
Oh, it's Apple, yeah. Oh, my God. That commercial freaked me out, man.
It's a great spot. It's a there's a two-minute spot that they show during the football on Thanksgiving.
Oh, is that when they aired it? Yeah,
he's playing the monster, and the funny thing about that is, you know, his TV father was Peter Boyle,
right?
Who was young Frankenstein in the movie?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, it was beautiful. It was like freaking me out how good it was.
Yeah, and Apple. Yeah,
and he's pretty recognizable, but he's Frankenstein too. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah. They filmed that in Prague. They actually went and filmed it in like a village that looks like where Frankenstein would live.
Like where Frankenstein Prague might
live.
Look
like that, it's like the Albuquerque of Europe.
He was in makeup and they just chased him out of town with torches.
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah, you did Letterman. That's something I never got to do. I always wanted to do it. When I started stand-up, I was like, if I could just get onto Letterman. And then I just watched that dream disappear. Like, Dave Letterman was like, I'm retiring in a year. I'm like, this is not going to happen. Did you do it a lot?
I got lucky with Carson.
Right.
Because Carson was retiring. He announced his retirement. And that's when I got asked to do my first spot on Carson in 91. I got to get in right under the gun with Carson.
Oh, that's so cool. That's so great. He was the best. I loved him.
Yeah, that was crazy. But then Letterman came after I got fired from news radio. I got hired. You know the show News Radio.
Yeah, I remember,
Yeah, so I was in the original cast. I was hired in the original cast. And
were you?
I was just a stand up. I wasn't really going. I didn't have an agent. I wasn't really going out for auditions. And the guy saw me. Paul Sims was the creator. He saw me on an HBO stand up special, and so he had me come in and read. And he said, "You're it, man. You're it." I thought he was just bullshitting.
It always feels like that when you get something, doesn't it?
Yeah. But he even said it. He said, "Listen, this is not bull. I'm not saying this, and you're going to walk out of here, and then we're going to say, okay, next." He goes, you're the guy. You're the guy.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I still didn't kind of believe it, but then we went home, and he said, yeah, we need you to fly out to L.A. And I'd been doing stand-up for, like, I guess about 10 years then. And
wow, okay.
And he said, fly out to L.A. We want you just got to read for the network, and then we're going to start rehearsing the next day, but it's in. You're it. You're in. saw my agents, and I didn't have an agent, so my manager got a James Dixon from William Morris, I remember.
And right.
They worked out a deal, whatever. I flew to L.A., and they were going to start rehearsing the next day, but I had to just read for the network the day before.
Yeah. Right, so you would do like a test.
Stressful.
Yeah, I guess they had to sign off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I read for the network, and it didn't go as well as the read for him, you know, for Paul Simms.
Right, right.
I thought, oh, that didn't feel that good. But then he told me after, he goes, that's okay. You know, I saw it in the original edition. He goes, no, you're in. So they signed me, and the next day was a table read. And at the right. table read, and it was Phil Hartman and Andy Dick and Maura Tierney. You know,
yeah, yeah. Great cast table, on that show, yeah.
And James Burrows was directing.
Okay.
At the table read, it felt, you know, in my gut, I felt it was even a little less good for me
than the second run for the network.
Yes. Like I couldn't match that audition I had with the guy Paul. And again, I had not been out for a lot of stuff. I hadn't been doing acting, and I hadn't been reading for stuff. So now at the table read, it feels a little less natural. And right. whatever, they were fine. And then the next morning was the first day of rehearsal. So we get to the first day of rehearsal, and it's James Burrows, and we're doing it, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm ad-libbing a little here and there. They're allowing a little bit of ad-libbing.
Right.
And the ad-libs are getting laughs, but but it just felt a little stilted. I felt a little stiff. I just felt it wasn't organic. But still, I was going through the motions. Everybody was...
Right. It never felt as good as that first audition, though.
No.
Right.
No. So that's it. Day one rehearsal over. The next day... I'm supposed to be on the set at 8, and at like, and by the way, me and my wife, you know, I was just making a living through stand-up. I was making, I don't know, you know, I had the kids then.
Yeah.
I had the three kids, and I was living in Queens, and I was, you know, in stand-up, it comes in spurts, you know, you got a lot of money, then all of a sudden you got no money. You got a lot of money, you know.
Yep.
That's how it was. You know, I was making a living, barely, but I was doing what I like to do, but... You know, we weren't comfortable, but I was happy
getting by, getting the bills paid, and
But I had to, you know, occasionally I had to pay. You know, my father had to spring me some money, and then I get a corporate gig or whatever, and I could pay him back. You know, that kind of thing.
Yep. You're charging your travel to a credit card, and then spending half of the gig money paying it off.
Well aware,
or letting it build up and not paying it off.
Right, and by the way, half the time I was just staying in the city and doing. You know, as many sets as I could in the city and making, you know, $20 during the week and $50 a set on the weekend.
Yeah.
But anyway, so my contract was going to be $8,000 an episode, which seems now like pennies, but for us then.
Oh, it was huge, right?
Going nuts.
Yeah, of course. They're like, that's more money than we've ever seen.
Yes. Scarface money.
Yes. So in day three in the morning, you know, I'm supposed to be there at 8 a.m., at 6:30, my phone rings in the hotel, and I kind of knew as soon as the phone rang, I kind of knew it was the call, and it was my manager Roy Rosegarden, and it was the classic line that actors some hear is they're going in another direction.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
like, where are they going?
Where are they going?
They're
where
lost.
Are they going? Oh, that sucks.
Yeah,
it's funny how you say you knew. Doesn't that happen sometimes, right?
Yes. If I'm being honest, I felt it in my gut.
Yeah.
It was a little too soon for me. It was a little, I just wasn't ready. And I it seems weird to say this. It was a bit of a relief.
Oh, yeah.
I was in over my head. I just felt like I was in over my head.
Yeah, you want something so badly, but you're not necessarily ready for it. It definitely feels like a relief when it goes away. And it's funny, sometimes you know. I knew my phone rang one day, and I looked at my girl and I said, this is the news that the show's not going to go.
Yeah.
And she was like, why would you think that? And I'm like,
I
don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I know. And of course, it was. Of course it was. So then what happened? You get the call.
Well,
pack your stuff and get out of the hotel.
Yes. My wife was. She took it harder because you know she's thinking of the kids and the money and all that.
Yeah.
And I went.
Little did she know what was just around the corner.
Yes, well, as fate would have it.
Yes, and there's today's topic is entering. Yeah.
Yes, I went back to New York, and the good thing is, look, when that happens to an actor, it's devastating. When that happens to a guy who's doing stand-up for a living, he still gets to do stand-up for a living.
Yeah. Isn't that our parachute right there, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love it.
You still get to do your thing.
They can't take away what you love.
Yeah.
Right. Now, look, having said that, you'd still like to get to the next level. And
sure.
Yeah, whatever that level is, it doesn't matter where you are, you want to get to that next level, right? Yeah.
Right. So I went back home and I did a... You know, that was like, that was December. They were filming that pilot in December. And you knew that show was going to go because it had all the people involved. And so it did go. But that, I believe it was that May, is when I got my first Letterman. And
right.
I went. And now at this time, I will say this. A lot of comics were getting development deals. You know, I had been around. So now I've been around for almost 11 years. And I did every show that a stand-up could do. I did the HBO Young Comedian. I did two Lenos. I did all the stand-up shows.
You Star know, Search?
I did Star Search, yeah.
Sorry.
I did One and Out. I did a One and Out in Star Search.
Oh, was it? Oh, I didn't know. I figured you won or came close to winning.
I lost the Geechee guy on the first one.
Geechee guy. Brad won, didn't he?
Yeah, he won the first one. He won year one.
That's why he gets all the Frankenstein work these days.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. That's funny you guys were on there together.
But anyway, yeah, but I was saying, look, man, if...
You've done all the shows, you're back in New York.
Yeah, no one's offering me anything. The development deal, you know, that no one's asking and no one's... My manager's not getting any bites or whatever.
Right.
And I thought, well, I'm doing Letterman. Letterman's the last thing that I, you know, that a comedian wants to do that I haven't really done. And that was exciting because now Letterman was the guy.
Yeah.
This is in 95, you know.
Yeah. I'm such a fan. I've loved Dave. I always loved him. I thought he was the best.
Yeah, he was the guy. I mean, Johnny was the guy before him, but now he's the guy.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And I went up and... Well, should I tell you the story about the pants?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What about the pants? Tell us about the pants. Yeah.
Well, here, so it's my first time on Letterman. I mean, I don't know if this is fate or what, because I read a little more into it than it is. But it was, so it's my first spot. So nobody knows me there. Dave doesn't know me. The audience, you know, I wasn't a household name. I was a working comic, but that's about it.
Right.
And so I'm in the green room and we're watching the show and Dave does a bit because it's May now and it's coming up into summer and he does a bit and the bit is about, he's going to summarize your pants. And the bit is he goes to Paul and he says, Paul, you need to summarize your pants. And he cuts Paul's pants.
He cuts them into shorts?
Into shorts, yes. While they're on his legs, he cuts them into shorts. And he pulls them off. And the crowd goes nuts, you know, and he's doing it. And then he takes a guy in the audience. That's what he does. He first goes to a guy in the audience, he does his. Then he does Paul's. Then Mel Gibson comes out. Mel Gibson's the first guest. And he cuts Mel Gibson's pants into shorts.
I vaguely remember this, yeah.
It does sound kind of familiar, yeah.
And then he says, hey, I'm a good sport if I'm not anything. And he cuts his own short pants.
Right.
The shorts.
And you're backstage this whole time.
I'm backstage. We're watching this. And somebody comes up to me, one of the producers. And I had the thought in my head. And he says, you got to cut your pants. Oh, I know who it was. It was Bill Sheff. You know the comic Bill Sheff?
Yeah, the cigar guy.
Yes, he works there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he said, you got to cut. I go, that's what I think. That's what I was thinking. And they get scissors. And we have scissors, and I'm ready. So now I'm going to be introduced to do stand-up and come out with my pants already cut into shorts.
Right.
And at the last second, I just thought it over, and I thought, you know what? I'm not I'm not in the club yet. You know,
right.
I'm an unknown guy, and I'm this guy coming out who nobody's ever heard before. And I'm going to walk out with my cut and be in on the joke and ha ha. And it felt like it would take away a little bit. It wouldn't be as humble as just being out there and being the guy, the new guy. You know?
Oh, I so get it. I so know exactly how you felt in yes. that moment. Yeah.
So I didn't do it.
So, okay. Yeah. You decided not to cut the
I did
cut
not
him.
Do it. And I'll cut to the chase. I have this set, and I have one of my best sets that I've ever done on TV, and Letterman signs me to a development deal, and that development deal becomes Everybody Loves Raymond. So I've always thought,
wow,
does everything change? Is it just the dynamic is just off slightly if I cut my pants before I went out, you know?
Oh, man.
Now, listen.
No, I'm right with you, man. I totally agree with you that it could have made a huge difference.
Well, isn't his production company Worldwide Pants?
Yeah, Worldwide Pants is the name of the company.
Yes, that's what
it is. It's not Worldwide Shorts.
Yes, Worldwide Pants. Yes, yes.
But totally. Like, if you came out with your pants cut into shorts, he might laugh, but he might also be like, who's this guy?
Right, but also...
Like you said, coming out, he's in on the joke? I don't even know this guy.
And what about the audience? The audience yeah. sees that and they're like, ah, ha, ha, ha. And yet, you know, there's a little bit of a presumptuousness to yeah. it, if that's a word.
Yeah. Yeah, but I could see why you would think of doing it because it's funny.
It's a fine line. It's a really fine call there. Tough call to make there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You might have felt slightly like you overstepped.
The door's open to be in the club, but is it really, how open is it? You know,
yeah.
You want to...
Well, just picture that happening and unknown comic walks out. Forget me. Just picture a guy you've never seen because there are guys that go on Letterman now who I've never seen before.
Right,
and if he comes out with his pants and his shins are showing,
he's got dress socks and hairy legs.
Yes, first of all, it's a little bit it's distracting in that sense. It's just visually distracting, right?
Yeah,
And it's also like, oh, he thinks he's one of the guys now. I don't know.
It could have rubbed him the wrong way.
Yeah, he had made his bones. So he's got
Letterman or the crowd, or it could have been a distraction, as you said, to the crowd, to hearing your act.
Off a tick. It just could have been off a tick. And maybe I feel self-conscious, and maybe I don't have a great set. And then, so cut to now, we get the show, and 10 years later, when the final episode was airing, in May of 2005 now.
Right.
I did Letterman that night, and I told the story to Dave, and we showed a clip. And I said, so now I feel it's okay to do. And we took the scissors out, and I cut my pants there. On
That's great.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Now, what did he say? Did you talk to him at all about how he might have?
Yeah, you know what he said? I told him that story, and I said how I don't think I would have. He said, in typical Letterman fashion, he goes, I think you would have done fine.
He just threw it all away. Yeah. I don't know, though. I still agree with you.
Yeah. I see where you're coming from. That is like, it's a fine line.
It's a bit neurotic to overanalyze it, but I think that's part of who we are. We're all kind of neurotic.
Oh yeah, and those little differences, I think they can make a big difference.
Well, the thing is, if you're performing,
those little things can affect how people see you and stuff. Yeah.
Yes.
And if there's that one little thing that you're not comfortable in, that's really what it boils down to. Is like you want to be able to be relaxed enough to deliver the set.
But also, in stand-up.
Yeah,
just in regular stand-up, when you walk out to a crowd and the crowd's never seen you before, I'm assuming now, you know, the crowd you're not known to this crowd. It's always the beginning. That beginning, I always feel comfortable if I have an opening that feels organic and natural, that I can say something about the guy before me or what's going on or the town or something.
Right.
And if it doesn't, if you have a clunky beginning,
oh God,
you know, but if you're doing 40 minutes, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, you'll recover from it, but it'll take you some time.
Yeah.
But on Letterman, you've got 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So
you can't have a clunky beginning.
Can't have a hole to dig out of.
yeah, if you come out of the gate a little and it's a little awkward, you've kind of blown the first 2-3 minutes, and and then what? Then no show. So,
and then nobody loves Raymond. So is it true? I heard this story before I knew you at all. I heard a story that you got a call while you were like, you did the show and then you were home like mowing your lawn.
Well, yeah, well, that's what happened was, so I do the set, and you know, I'm hard on myself too, but I had to admit that that was a good set. That was a good,
right.
If I'm going to have a Letterman set and here's my chance, you know, if I'm going to get a development deal, somebody's going to see this. And, you know, we went home, and I don't know what day of the week that was, but I know it was I know this was a Saturday.
Right.
When I'm in Queens now, I'm in a house in my house that I live in, Middle Village, Queens, and
right.
And I'm in the backyard, and my wife comes out and says Rob Burnett is on the phone, and Rob Burnett was the exec producer then of Letterman.
Right. Right.
I'm like, what?
Like,
you know, it's.
Like, did I grow up with a guy named Rob Burnett?
Well, I didn't know he had. First of all, I didn't know he had my number. Second of all, it's a Saturday. Third of all, he's Jewish. He shouldn't be making phone calls on a Saturday. But I literally was in the back, you know, and I had these two little twins. I was probably hosing them off or something. I don't know what I was doing.
You often have to hose them off, twins. Yeah.
And that's when he offered me a development deal. He said, listen, Dave loved what he saw. You know, they were in the business then. World Wide Pants was in the business of trying to come up with a show.
Yeah.
And he says, I just want to tell you we're interested. So if anyone else asks, don't sign with them because we're interested. And I told him right there, nobody's asking, man.
Don't worry. I'm here in my yard by myself. Yes. Nobody's offering me development deals.
And we signed a deal. I mean, I had a development deal. I had for 1 year, they held me, and I think it was, I remember it was 50 grand for the year, which is, I know sounds like a lot of money, but to a lot of people, but nowadays, I mean, oh, not nowadays, but
even then when everybody gets their cuts and all that stuff, it's
yeah.
Less.
Yeah, well, for a whole year.
Also development deals now, there are guys getting tons more for that, you know.
Oh, guys, we're getting big deals there, and for a while, yeah.
Yeah, but I remember celebrating. I didn't figure that we were going to get a show out of it. But I remember I bought a set of clubs. I bought a set of Yonex golf clubs.
Nice.
And that was my celebration that I had a deal. Not thinking it would go anywhere, but then I met Phil Rosenthal, and here we are.
Wow. Yeah. And how long the show?
Now I'm in Albuquerque. Hey, you want to know a funny story?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll take all the funny stories you got.
I'm going to tell you a full circle story.
Okay.
And it's going to sound like it's going to sound a little dickish that I'm talking myself up, but that's not the point of this story.
I have one like that. Okay.
Okay. So
we'll try not to call you a dick in the middle.
All right. I just want to give you a full circle thing.
Okay.
So
okay.
News radio was $8,000 was going to be $8,000 an episode, and I was like over the moon, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that goes away. Raymond comes along.
Rogan, fucking Rogan.
No,
bastard.
No, it was
no, I'm just kidding.
It wasn't Rogan's fault. So that goes away.
Right.
Raymond comes along. First year, I signed for $20,000 an episode. I think I'm the least paid cast member on the cast right there. maybe Brad Garrett was.
Yeah, maybe Brad, right? But it's Peter Boyle and Doris Roberts, Boyle, right?
Doris Roberts, right? Okay, so second year, the show's a modest hit. Then second year it goes up to 50, I guess. I don't know. Then we move to Monday nights. Boom. Then it goes up to like 100. Then it goes to 250. And then I'm only signed for 5 years. So in the fifth year, it goes crazy, you know. It goes to 7. It goes to whatever.
Wow.
And now 8. It goes to. I mean, this is already documented, so I'm not saying anything that I shouldn't be saying.
And we know you're not just bragging about how much money you made.
And I'm not bragging about it.
No, no.
It goes to. It's nuts. It's retarded. It goes to almost 2.1 an episode.
Oh my God, dude.
Okay. All right. That's before taxes. I see 30 cents on a dollar. Okay. So that
it all goes to your wife anyway. We know.
Yeah. So that goes. Oh, yes, that's true. Okay. So then Raymond goes away.
Right.
I'm blessed. I'm blessed. I don't, whatever. And then Men of a Certain Age. I saw Men of a Certain Age.
Great show, by the way. I love that show.
Thank you. Me and Royce, whatever. And now, so now, of course, I'm like, so I get 170 an episode, whatever it is, TNT. Okay. And now I'm not doing these things for money, but, and then that goes away and Parenthood comes up and Parenthood starts and it's 35,000 an episode.
Right.
And I'm not doing it for the money. I like the show. I love the show. I love the guy.
Right. You want to work. You want to act.
I thought it was good. I thought it was good. I just wanted to do it because I thought it was quality stuff.
It's a good show. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's 35. And then the next season, it stays the same. My third season, they're only going to do 13 episodes and then they're done. And the guy calls me and says, listen, the network can only afford you for 2 episodes. I go, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, but we want you for all 13. Now, look, you don't have to do it, but if you agree to top of show, I can get you for all 13. I go, let's do it. So what's top of show? 8,000 an episode. I went full circle.
Full circle. All the way back to news radio. You're like, I know what comes after this. That morning phone call.
Right. Yes.
Luckily,
I wasn't, I don't have to do it for the money. So it was all about the work. But it was very interesting that I went right from where I was all the way around.
Yeah, right back to that, it sounds like a great journey and not even a bad place to end up. Right?
It's good to be making 8,000 an episode, and to be feeling like, I'm doing it because of the work and the money. I'm not doing it for the money, as opposed to making 8,000 episode and that being, that's like saving your family's life and then you get fired from that.
That's everything. Yeah. And then it gets taken away. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing, man. I feel like I'm in.
That was like the Odyssey, right there.
Yeah.
It's like,
wow. All the way around and back. I feel like I'm a comedian because of fate or destiny, as it were. When I got started in comedy, I was 21. And I decided I was going to move to LA to get into movies. I always loved movies. They were like my favorite thing ever. And I just wanted to get into movies and act and in any capacity, really. So I decided to move to LA. And I had plans to move out there with my then girlfriend who, breaks up with me. And then I'm like, well, shit, we're going to move to LA together. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm still going to move to LA. Fuck it. And I'm leaving right now. So I literally pack a backpack and a blanket and go to Newark Airport at 4 in the morning. And I write a check that I don't have the funds to cover to then Continental Airlines.
Really?
And I go and I get on a plane and I'm all for it. I'm all for it all the way through. And then I'm sitting on the plane and suddenly I realize what I'm doing and that I don't know anyone in LA and I'm scared shitless. And I'm sitting there. And I'm so scared that I am literally closing my eyes and hoping that I will wake up and be at home. I want it so badly to be off that fucking plane and home in my bed. I'm scared to death. And I'm closing my eyes and I'm praying, please let me get off this plane and go home. Please let me get off this plane and go home. And while I'm doing that, I hear this guy like 2 rows in front of me on the other side of the aisle. Oh, no, 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 no. He starts screaming, yelling. He stands up. We're out. We're getting ready to take off. This guy's got his seatbelt off, and he's standing up on the plane, arms flailing, and he's screaming and yelling. This Japanese guy. No one can understand what he's saying. He doesn't speak any English.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there praying for a chance to get off the plane. This guy gives me one. He stands up on the plane that's live taxiing on the runway, and so they shut down the plane. And the emergency vehicles come out. Turns out the guy has left his wallet that had like $3,000 cash in it in the men's room by the gate. And he's just realized it. So they've stopped the flight, and the pilot, and I'm just sitting there. I cannot believe what is happening. I'm like, I've been praying for a chance to get off this plane, and now I think I could. The pilot literally comes over and says, tells us what happened. This guy forgot his wallet. He left it in there with a lot of cash. We're going to let him off the plane. We're going to continue on. And he literally says, if there's anyone else on the plane who would like to get off, here's your chance.
Really?
Yep. And I didn't get off.
You didn't get off.
I didn't get off. I was scared, so scared that I was praying for a chance to get off, and then I got one, and I stayed on the fucking plane. I just said, I'm not getting off. I'm going to go. It was
you were like, all right, I just wanted to prove that I could do it.
I just wanted to prove I could make something happen.
But wait, so you not getting off was the better decision, you're saying?
It was.
In L.A. is where your career started.
When I got to L.A., that's when I randomly happened to fall into stand-up. Even though I was a class clown and a smartass and a comedian of sorts my whole life, I didn't know it, and I wasn't planning to go there to do that. But I stayed on the plane, and I went to L.A., and I found a buddy that I knew from high school. We rented a place together, and... Yeah. I stumbled into a job at the Comedy Store on Sunset. I couldn't get a job. I had this great experience working in a five diamond hotel here in Jersey. Not five star, five diamond, which if you know, which is a real thing, and it's really way, way beyond a five star hotel. It's like hard as hell to achieve it. So
really?
I had these great references from that job. No one in LA gave a shit about my hotel experience in New Jersey. Yeah. Couldn't get a job anywhere, stumbled into a job at the Comedy Store by, like, I came out of that hotel next door, which was then the Riot Hyatt. You know that place, Ray? It was like, used to be where all the rock bands stayed and partied. And
oh, really?
Yeah. So I came out of there. I didn't get the job. This is a hotel like three tiers below the one I've been working in. Didn't get the job. End up talking to this guy out in front. Who turns out to be a guy who's looking for someone to answer the phones at the Comedy Store and offers me the job. So I take the job 3 days a week, 4 hours a day or something, $5, right. $5.50 an hour. And that's what led to me getting on stage.
Well, did you have no desire, no, you never entertained the thought of being a stand-up before that, before you started working there? You must have had something in you.
I don't, you know, it seems, looking back, it seems like I must have, because from the time I was in fourth grade or something, that's all I ever really wanted to do was make the other kids laugh.
Right.
But I'd never, I really never thought about it. I was a crazy kid. Like, people are like, what do you want to do when you get older? And I would be like, I want to have fun.
Yeah, it's true, because I was like always into watching stand-up, and I was always into performing. You know, in college, I took drama class or whatever.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
And I was always into making people laugh too. But I never really said, why don't I get up and do it, until I heard about the audition night or whatever, you know?
Right, right.
And that's when I said, hey, wait a minute. Why don't I try it? Yeah.
Yeah, I stumbled into it. This guy, I was telling this crazy story. There's more to that whole story. But the one I was just telling you guys about the plane and everything. And some guys thought I was a comedian and said, hey, how long have you been doing stand-up? Do you want to do our show on Saturday? This one
Saturday,
guy. And that's how I did it. My first show ever was on a Saturday in the belly room, the little room upstairs at the store.
That's sweet.
Wait a minute. Your first show was on a Saturday? It wasn't like an audition night?
It was a Saturday night at like midnight, though, in the belly room. What was your first one? What was the audition? Did you do it?
That was at the Improv in Manhattan on 44th and 9th. That doesn't exist anymore. But
I remember,
you know, the Improv,
I remember that place.
Yeah, it's one of the, I think it's arguably one of the first club that ever existed. There's always a discrepancy between that and Pips in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Right, yeah, both say they're the original, the oldest,
right.
Yeah.
But so I heard about, they have audition night once a month, the first Sunday of every month. And you have to go down in the afternoon, and they give out 20 spots, and if you know they put numbers in a hat, and if there's 40 people there, everybody picks out of the hat numbers from 1 to 20, And if you get a blank, tough luck, you're not going on that night.
Oh, right. Yeah, then you're not on.
And if you get a number, you're on at that position. That's the position you go on that night.
Right.
So I took a girl with me who I was working with, not a girlfriend in that sense, but just a friend.
Right.
And although I wanted her to be my girlfriend. So I said, I took her and she said she would come with me. And, you know, the guy comes outside of the improv. It's a Sunday afternoon. There's 40 people standing around. He has a hat with all the pieces of paper in it. And he just, everybody grabs one. And I told her, you grab one, I'll grab one. And this way we have a double the chance of getting a number.
Nice, yeah.
And I said, now, if you get a number and I don't, because they ask you your name right away, they write the name down on a clipboard, you know, and that's the name you, and that's, that person goes on that night. I said, if you get one, you give them a name, but I'll go on that night as that name. So I had to, we had to think of an androgynous name because the guy's going to look at her and say, what's your name?
She's like Ray Romano.
Yeah, her name's, yes, Ray, but it's spelled with an E.
Yeah, so, yeah. Ray, like Ray Don Chong.
Yeah. No, but I said, say Jackie Roberts, because Jackie could be a guy or a girl. So sure enough, she got it. I got a blank. So she said Jackie Roberts. So the guy wrote Jackie Roberts. So then you go home, and that night I went on as Jackie Roberts.
That's great.
And
that's
I got a call back. Silver's there, and Silver Freeman, and
right
from the club. And she gave me a call back, which means you come back next month. And now you don't have to pick a number. Now you got a call back. You just go. But I couldn't tell it then that I was that's not my name. So, and I went back to Jackie Roberts, and she passed me. And I was nervous. So like for the first 2 months, I was Jackie Roberts. That was my stage name.
That's great. You just did that everywhere you went as Jackie Roberts. That's hilarious. It's a very real name. It feels like a name, like someone I've heard of. I'm like, is that a real comedian? Yeah, yeah, Jackie Roberts is perfect.
Yeah, Jackie Roberts does sound like a vaudeville guy or something, you know?
Yeah.
You're like an insult comic, like a Rickles or something.
Well, Jackie
you
Martin,
hockey
you
puck.
Jackie,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Jackie Martin. Yeah.
You're now, from now on, Ray, you are Jackie the Joke Man Roberts.
Yeah. I should use that as an alias. I haven't even thought of that. I'm using that when I check into a hotel. Well, now I can't because I told you guys.
Yeah, it's going to be everywhere now that you said it on Tall But True.
Well,
I think I quit, actually. I think after 3 months as Jackie Roberts, I probably bombed somewhere because I know I – no, what happened was I know I started and quit like at least two times after bombing. You know, I would quit for a year and then go back.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, I remember that old that improv. That when I first moved to New York, that was – I did that whole thing where you put it, the hat and you hope you get the number, and I couldn't get on anywhere. I was like, you know, you hit some open mics or everything. So my a friend of mine told me about this place in Harlem, the Uptown, and he's like, you're a white dude. If you go up there, you'll definitely get on just for being a novelty. And so I'd go there on the weekends, and it would be packed. They'd have packed shows.
Right.
And
that's balls, man.
Well, it was like, you get on. You know, you get on. And you know, my name is Ben Wartofsky, but nobody could say my name. So the guy who Uncle Jimmy Mack, the guy who died in the Tracy Morgan car accident,
right, yeah.
He named everybody names. And he's like, he could not say my last name. And so he's like, you're from D.C., you're Benny. You're going to be DC Benny. He just names one Brooklyn Mike, who was from Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah, I remember that guy. Mike.
Yeah.
He named everybody, huh?
Yeah. So I get the name and everything. So
Tracy Morgan's real name is Jackie Roberts, it turns out.
But I'm working, and it was great. You know, it was like a great, you know, starting round, but I still couldn't get in the sort of mainstream rooms, the improv and the comic strip and all. I couldn't. So, and I remember it was a big deal back then that show Def Jam had come out. It's like if you could get on Def Jam, that was so they had these auditions to get on Def Jam in Jersey and East Orange, this place called the Peppermint Lounge.
Oh, okay.
And it was like,
I thought you were going to say Rascals. They had a Rascals there for a while.
It was a Peppermint
Lounge. Peppermint Lounge, all right.
And it was a rough spot. It was a rough spot, you know. So
I went
there to go do the Def Jam auditions. It was rough. And I remember this guy, Bob, he was sort of he booked the acts and everything. And I had an audition. And it was, you know. So Right before me, this guy comes up with six strippers.
Wow.
And the place goes nuts. Like, the place just goes nuts. And he's telling jokes while these strippers are dancing. I mean, it's like you can't even imagine. And at the end, one of the strippers pulls a lighter out and lights her pubic hair on fire. And the place and the guy drops and the place just goes ballistic. And then Bob guy turns to me. He's like, you're going to follow that? He's like, nobody. He's like, just go home. We'll get you another audition. I'm like, dude, I'm here. You know, I'm going to do it. So I went up, and I remember grabbing a fire extinguisher on the way up from like the wall, like spraying the air or something. Went on, had a great set, kind of like a standing ovation. It was like, because I kind of made fun of the fact that it was like strippers. It was just odd how odd it was. Because it was,
yeah, that's very strange.
It was just strange. And the setting, the pubic hair on fire, whatever. So the Bob guy's like, hey, man, we're going to, you got to, you know, get you on Def Jam. It's going to happen. You'll be the first white guy, blah, blah, blah. So it doesn't happen, and I'm crushed. I'm just crushed, you know.
Yeah.
I think Voss becomes the guy. And we well-deserved it, well-deserved. So I'm crushed, but I get a call.
Yeah, it is Voss. He told me that the first 100 times I met him.
Yeah,
well, that sure. He was the first white guy on Def Jam.
Well,
he has it on a jacket.
Long story short, I get a call. There's another show, Showtime at the Apollo. And the producer was there that night. She was like, you're the dude with the fire extinguisher. she goes, come on out. I don't know if we're taping this Sunday. And I'd never had any TV or anything or whatever, you know.
Right.
She goes, we're taping this Sunday. And you're not on, but maybe we might be able to squeeze you on or something. So I go out that Sunday. Again, the crowd's really rough that day. Really rough. They're booing. They boo off Steve Harvey's hosting it. They boo him off. He comes off with like the toupees all tilted. You know, she comes out, the producer. They boo her off. And there's an act that's supposed to go on. They're like, we don't want to go on. We're not going on to that crowd. So she looks at me. She's like, you want to go on? You can say whatever you want. I'm like, all right, I'll go on. So I go on.
Nice, dude.
Before I go on, Steve Harvey comes out. He's like, there's not a lot of opportunities for black performers. You know, because this whole
including
speech.
This next
this
set.
This whole speech, right? And I'm getting really uncomfortable. I'm really uncomfortable. He's like, because I'm white, man. And then he's like, but this next guy, we're going to bring him out. And so I go out and I said, surprise, right? And people laugh, you know? And I had a great set. It was my first TV set. And
it was Showtime at the Apollo.
It was Showtime at the Apollo. And
it's Showtime.
It, you know.
At the Apollo.
Look, it didn't lead. I think, you know, eventually it may have led to two others. And the last one is now on YouTube and it's got like, you know, like almost 10 million views on it.
Holy shit.
So it's like it's lasted. It was a good thing. It put me a little bit on the map. I mean, it's not on the scale of what we were talking about, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it was a little something, a little getting into the door.
The last Showtime at the Apollo is on YouTube.
Yeah, but it's you know, it's old, it's dated material. I will say that. But
you don't light your pubes on fire at the end of your set, do you?
I don't,
because that's hack.
Yeah, that takes that. First of all, that does take balls. You're right. You're right, Ben.
Yeah.
Because I probably would, when the woman let her pubes, if that guy gave me the out.
Okay.
But you know, yeah, you're so desperate when you're younger. You're so desperate to get the foot in, you know?
But it's so funny because that's a lot of people, like a lot of, you know, when actors come up to me and ask for advice on how to get in the business, it's hard for me to really give them advice that I, through experience, because I came up through stand-up, you know?
Yeah,
But it's probably the same thing applies, because in stand-up, the advice you give a guy is go on stage anywhere and everywhere, you know?
Yeah, every chance you
get. Absolutely. Anywhere you can.
As much stage time as possible.
Yeah. Right, because even the shitty ones, you learn from them, you know?
Yeah, you might find something great in one of your bits.
Well, you hope down the line.
Even if the crowd sucks, you might go, oh, this works.
But you hope as you're in it, you know, down the line when you're making a living, hopefully you don't have to do as many shitty ones.
Yes. And you learn to smell them.
But even the shitty ones, you learn.
Yeah.
You kind of learn how to bob and weave with an audience. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Absolutely.
A little bit. I mean, look, don't get me wrong. we know it can be horrible too.
Yes.
There are those times. It's funny, but like you can tell if a gig might be.
Yeah.
You know, you get the call about it or whatever, and you're like, okay.
When they tell you that thing about there's going to be an intermission before you're going to go on so they can sell more drinks at the open bar or whatever, you know.
We got to do an episode about hell gigs. I'm sure there's some great stories about that.
Did you guys ever do Betty's Fireside? Were you around then?
Oh, yeah. That's out this way. That's pretty close to where we are right now. That was Denville, New Jersey, yeah.
Yeah, because that's legendary for the that'll be the when you do the one on Hell Gigs, I'm sure that'll get the most mentions.
It does come up even when you mention Hell Gigs. People are like, "Oh, you remember Betty's Fireside?"
It sounds horrible.
Oh, it was not a great gig. The woman would come out and she'd say, "Okay, you can't say the C word. If you use a C word, you don't get paid." And I'm like, no one ever made me want to use a C word more than you, lady.
Yes.
I had no plans to, but man, you're really making me want to right now.
Yeah.
So it's funny, yeah, we all have these little things. If one little thing had been different,
yeah,
like if that whoever was supposed to be on at the Apollo that night didn't chicken out and say, we're not doing this.
I was so thankful that they were checking out. Yeah.
Yeah, then you wouldn't have had that opportunity to go on and everything might be totally different.
Yeah.
All right.
Ray, if you had to cut your pants into shorts, you might have been a little more comfortable.
It's the Wally Pip. It's the Wally Pip and the, you know that story, right? Lou Gehrig was Wally Pip was the first baseman for the Yankees, and he got sick one day and couldn't play.
Right.
And Lou Gehrig took his place, and Lou Gehrig had the record for the most games played ever until
Cal Ripken. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And he was just sitting on the bench until...
Right.
What was his name? Wally Pip?
I believe it was Wally Pip.
Wally Pip.
Like Pete Best. It's the Pete Best.
It's the Pete Best, yeah. Yeah, that's like... That one just hurts just to hear that. You know, just to think about, like, you were the drummer for the Beatles.
Well, I think John Heyman... I don't know if you remember the comic John Heyman. He's still around. But he used to do a bit about Pete Best. He goes, do you think Pete Best... just wakes up every morning and goes, fuck!
Yeah, I think he probably does. He just rolls over and for a minute he doesn't remember.
Right.
You know, and then it comes back like that punch in the stomach when you forget about some awful shit. He just goes, God damn it.
Yeah.
I'm going to start a band. Well, that was great, man. This was a great episode. Thanks. Ray, thanks so much for joining us on the show, man. Those are great stories.
Fantastic.
Edit it up to sound good.
I don't think we have to do much, man. I think it's all good.
But it was also illuminating.
Cool, and good luck with the new show. Get Shorty. Can we tell people when and where that'll be on yet, or do you not know?
I don't think